The theme of the evening talk is life is ever opening. Many of you may know the term vipassana. Vipassana is a Buddhist Pali term or word that means to see things clearly, to see life directly, to see it without distortion, without confusion, without ignorance. It also means insight or wisdom, which sometimes is loosely translated as mindfulness. It means a lot of things. And any time you take something from one tradition or one culture or one part of the world or one language and attempt to move it into another culture or group or civilization or language, there is the possibility, and it's a very real possibility, that what's essential can get lost. What we actually know is that what the historical Buddha, as one awakened being, taught was passed from person to person. It was oral, it was direct, it was from human being to human being. And what I'm saying right now is that it was essentially beyond words. It was beyond language. And yet, this talk, as any talk would, will attempt to use words to point to something that the word cannot reach. But yet the word can point. So the word vipassana is a pointer. It is pointing towards realization. It is pointing towards insight. It is pointing towards wisdom. It is pointing towards awakening. What brings us, if I might suggest, into a situation like this is a longing to be free. The longing to be unencumbered. The longing to be complete, to be whole, to be happy, to be peaceful. The longing to experience what is really true or real. The longing in the human being can at times intensify into something that could be called craving and grasping. And the craving and grasping, often unbeknownst to in our conscious mind, can, when penetrated, you could say, or when really felt, it can be sensed to be longing for an answer to the longing. It can intensify at times in human beings further into desperation and despair and other type states of feeling, heart, mind, body, when the longing is not relieved. Also, this longing can, you might say, thin down or distill down into curiosity and interest, which sounds very different than longing, doesn't it? If you consider what is meant by curiosity for you or interest, you might come up with something quite different than longing. And yet I'm suggesting that longing, when thinned down, when distilled, can also arise as curiosity and interest. Now, you or I or others may not be feeling that you've come here because of longing, but rather you are in fact curious, maybe. You're interested, you're keen to find out what life really is. What can meditation actually do? If millions of people for thousands of years have been meditating on planet Earth, why are they doing it? You may have come here because you want to know your real nature, your true, your original nature. You may find that that's the center of your life, is to know that. For some human beings, no one else's experience, no book, no tape, no lecture, no spot, physical spot on planet Earth, as beautiful as those things may be, can satisfy this longing, curiosity, interest to know one's true original nature. Another way to say that, to know what you really are. So again, unbeknownst to ourselves at times, the longing, however it may appear, is longing for something that will end the longing. Because there's a sense that if the longing wasn't here, then perhaps everything would be all right just as it is. Everything would be at ease just as it is. The longing suggests otherwise, doesn't it? This longing is part and parcel of the seeker. Human beings don't place themselves, so to speak, on a spiritual or religious path, whatever that is, unless they're seeking. Because we've heard, some of us, and we've heard it as children, and we've heard it in different places, and we've heard it in different ways. Seek and ye shall find. And the seeker searches for answers. Why is there suffering? Why is there hardship? Why is there pain? Why is there inequality? Why is there injustice? Why is there aloneness? Why is there loneliness? Why am I here? Why is there a sense of separation? Is there a way out? Who am I? The seeker may ask these questions, or any other number of questions. And the seeker wants an answer. And the seeker isn't satisfied with words. The seeker wants to know. No, the seeker wants to experience. So whether this longing is thickening up into grasping, craving, or further into desperation and despair, or this longing is thinning down, the longing, the arising of longing, is the natural consequence of an occurrence early in this body-mind development, early developmentally. This occurrence, tucked away in the memory bank, tucked down in the so-called unconscious of psychology, tucked down in the recesses of this cellular matrix, this occurrence is the arising of the me perception, which unfolds itself into the idea of being an individual. The formation of a center, distinct and perceived as separate at times from everything else. Distinction is one thing, separation is another. Life, in all its wholeness, completeness, fullness, its oneness, its tapestry of oneness, life, in those ways, has, for reasons beyond our comprehension, contracted itself into a sense of individualness. And it's exactly this individual idea, belief, perception, feeling, that longs for wholeness or longs to come home. Follow that? It's exactly this individualness that longs, seeks to come home or to rest. Yet it can't rest. Not too long can it rest when it feels separate from things around it. And so once we've discovered what it means to be intimate with another human being, and we've found that it's a mixed bag, at times it's wonderful, it's so pleasant and yet troubling and confusing. But once we found that intimacy with another human being, we don't forget that, not easily. We don't forget that feeling of connectedness, call it love if you like. The individual doesn't forget that. In fact, the individual at times longs to return to that with other human beings. One's children, one's partner, one's lover, one's parents. Sometimes for me, before coming to these events, life has a way of intensifying and piling up. The phone starts ringing and the emails increase. And sometimes it goes further because there's a lot of people in my life who are getting close right now to not being embodied, you could say. They're ready to die. Dear mom and dad among them. So the phone calls are coming into late last night from my brother who I don't hear from for a year at a time. And suddenly here he is. Call your sister. The individual that's woven into this experience of connectedness and intimacy with all things, not just other humans. So again, this individual idea, and while I'm on that, let me suggest that's all it is. Sometimes the idea is deeply believed in. That can change how it configures and feels. But it's an idea born from the me perception that happened somewhere back in there that we don't remember. It longs for wholeness, that individualness does. It longs for wholeness. It longs for completeness. It longs for home. And if you, as a so-called being or individual, are here for some other reason, fundamental reason, other than what I'm talking about or trying to talk about tonight, don't hesitate to come and enlighten me in a small group meeting as to why you're really here. This is one of the most difficult things I've found to do in my life, sit up here and talk to you, but I love it inside and out. Something has to die every time I make one of these talks. Or one of these talks gets made through me. The longing is ironic and often unbeknownst to itself. It's longing for its own death or dissolution. That's irony. Longing for an end to the longing. The individual idea sense, somehow, it doesn't want to die either, sometimes, does it? You're having so much fun being you, you don't want to go to sleep. Because the you that you're having fun being is going to go away when you go to sleep. And sometimes there's a you, an individual sense, that arises in the dream state, and it's so fun you don't want to wake up. And so you find a way to get one of those alarms that has many, many different snooze options. And you perfect it. Can I get that to go like that with the barest amount of movement? The longing in the individual sense, the longing as the individual sense, it's a way it's bipolar. It's seeking home, but it's afraid to die. It understands somehow, though, that if home is to come, if completeness is to come, it must die. We're not quite sure where home is, but we'd surely like to go there if we could figure out how. Can I still be an individual in the ways that I like and be home too? I remember when I lived in California and I'd been exposed to these teachings and I'd been exposed to them in a way that was very rigorous and almost boot campish, intense, like there was no walking meditation, it was just sitting. Sit. We just sat. And we were asked not to move from the very beginning, not a muscle. And if you went to lie down even a little bit, one of the managers was right there with their hand behind your back. No, you can't do that. You can't point your feet at the teacher, all these things that I don't talk about here. Start pushing all kinds of buttons. What? We have to? Anyways, it was very boot campish. Then I get out to California. You know California. Go west, young man, young woman, go west. Get out there and boy, what a plethora. So the Dharma's everywhere, right? Well, the Dharma that I dropped into in California, people are coming to the Dharma talk sitting in lounge chairs with Coca-Colas in the armrests. Pointing their feet wherever they want. I mean, why not? If you live in Marin County, go for it. Let's have it all, baby. I want to have it exactly the way I want, and I want the purest Dharma at the same time. And somehow it all works. Have you noticed? Good, the bad, the ugly, the evil, it all somehow appears. And ultimately, and it doesn't matter what your interpretations are, what your judgments are, what your conclusions are, it's still unfolding. It, life. The idea of being an individual with a concurrent sense of separation fuels and perpetuates the longing. And it appears that we're the only creatures, perhaps, us humans, that have this peculiar trait or tendency. Trees, plants, rocks, water, clouds, dogs, cats, whales, and birds, and a lot of other sentient beings. They don't seem to have this longing for release from the sense of separation. In fact, it seems very likely that dogs, cats, birds, whales, and parakeets don't even experience the sense of separation in the first place. Of course, are we going to be able to figure that one out? I mean, some of us might feel we must rush out after this retreat and get a parakeet that talks and ask it, "Do you experience a sense of separation?" Got to watch out here, because sometimes in these environments of silence, things get planted, and once they get planted, you got to do it. It won't go away. The idea of being an individual, once firmly mobilized and reinforced through contact with other human beings who also experience and believe in this, is the breeding ground for a whole slew of additional ideas and perceptions. The first is the perception of linear time and defined space within which this individual body-mind exists. Okay? Time, linear time, is a perception, conditioned into the mind and born from the sense of individuality. It perceives itself as separate from other things. Space, notice the sense of space. Space is a perception. Maybe a space that doesn't have any edge, like the night sky. Space inside the body. Space around the body. Space in this room. This is all perception. This is conditioned into the mind. It's learned. This individual sense must and will unfold itself within this continuum of time and space. And these things are arbitrary and subjectively defined. How do we know this is true? Because linear time goes in and out of consciousness all day long. Not to mention that when we're in the deep sleep state, there is no time. There's no clock. There is no past. There is no future. There is no present. See, even that's a measurement of time, isn't it? Present. And how the mind constructs that as different than past or future sometimes. These are constructions of mind. These are thoughts, perceptions, beliefs. But they don't stop there. It becomes something that human beings feel as real. And if you talk and relate to other people who also feel this is real, particularly if they're your parents, and they start telling you how it is, it's pretty hard to say, you know what? You're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. Now, every now and then, a young kid will pull that one out, because they'll be still blasted into the unicity of things, opened into that spaciousness of being to an extent that somebody tries to contract them and they won't have anything to do with it. They literally run away. Some of you may know the Buddhist monk Bhante Gunaratana. It'd be his done some meditation with him, and maybe some others know of him. Beautiful human being from Sri Lanka. He's been a monk since childhood. And he's an elder in the Theravada, Western Theravada, not just Western, international Theravada, Buddhist community. Beautiful human being. I love him. He used to let the hair grow out of his ears. He didn't bother to cut it. So he'd have like handlebar mustaches with the hair coming out of his ears. He'd let it go out to like about 2 inches. I don't think he was curling it or waxing it, but there's just no self-consciousness. Like, who cares? And he was beautiful. And one day he was giving a Dharma talk, and I was getting a little antsy. And I was feeling like, it's not really getting to it, Bhante, for me. So sometimes for me, when that happens, I got to do something. And I got to act on that. So he finishes the talk, and he says, any questions? And I was like, okay, I think I got one. Bhante, what are you attached to? He smiled, and he went, I'm a child. I know I'm not supposed to be, but I'm attached to the meditation itself. We're childlike wonder beings at the same time. We perceive ourselves as individuals separate from that which we live in, even linear time and space, we're somehow separate from that. Although we've created that. And it doesn't stop there. This individual sense, this perception of linear time, this perception of definable space, unfolds itself into the idea of journey or path. You see, because if there's an individual and there's linear time and there's definable space, then there must be a path or journey that that individual is unfolding on. Right? The feeling idea that we're on a journey, that we're on a path, and that we're going somewhere. In many cases, the idea is invested in going someplace better. Better than where we are, or at least as good if where we are is pretty good. Okay, can I have some continuity here? Because I got it together. Okay, I like my house, I like my this, my car's nice. Okay, I got my spot, my meditation, my job. My this, my that. Human beings sometimes go, can I plateau? Just hold it. It's like that's like trying to hold your breath. You notice that? You're going against the nature. The force of life is going to push you to breathe again. But the mind can do it, can it? I like it here. Can we just stay a little longer? And of course the Italians have mastered this in part through the notion of savoring. I loved being in Italy because any sense of wanting it to happen now, especially in the restaurants, was shattered. Where's the waiter? I've been here for 45 minutes. I think that's him. He just walked by 3 times. He looked at me. He's still walking. Where's the water? Can I have a menu? Are you open? Hello? And then they appear with all the grace and interest and care, and then it goes on for hours. I literally got so uncomfortable, I almost ran out of one of those situations once. Just let me out of here. I can't take it. I'm going to die if something doesn't happen. That's an individual sense, huh? Linear time, space, on a journey, path. Let me out of this restaurant. It doesn't stop there, though. Individuality, perception of linear time and space, path, or journey has embedded within it the sense that the individual has free will and choice. And if we get clear enough, deserving enough, steady enough, meditative enough, relaxed enough, spiritual enough, make enough good choices, stop making bad choices, we can be free and enlightened. Or at least better off. That we can direct our lives into deeper meaning or purpose. And of course, the deepest meaning or purpose can vary. Have we noticed that? And generally, it means different kinds of wealth, health, happiness, peace, love, service to a better world, or enlightenment. That's the deeper meaning or purpose. And as many books and tapes and people who will sell or give away these ideas. That's what they are. They're ideas. These ideas are taught. They're conditioned into the mind, just like the perception of apple is conditioned into the mind. There was a time in the unfoldment of this body-mind process, this one right here, where there was no perception of apple. There was no perception of ocean. There was no concept of water. There was direct sensory. These ideas that I'm speaking of, conditioned into the mind, and they're passed down from human being to human being, from generation to generation, and they're brought in at a very tender and innocent age, chronologically. Now, this can get a bit confusing, because once the idea of meaning or purpose is present in the mind, then it doesn't take very long to realize that no one can define meaning or purpose that is consistent across the board for everybody. Have we noticed this? What that means, then, is that human beings are making up their own definitions of meaning and purpose. And sometimes that's constructed as being free to know what your meaning and purpose is. Of course, that's pointing to the individual, isn't it? Because if it was the same meaning and purpose for everybody, then there would be no individual, right? It would just be us. Usness. So that suggests that there is no ultimate meaning or purpose. There are constructions that individuals make up of meaning and purpose. But we can't get agreement across the board, can we? Boy, we can't, can we? Even though we'll fight over it. We'll take it to the worst of so-called dastardly deeds on planet Earth in the name that we can't agree what the meaning and purpose is. So we look for meaning and purpose in the world, don't we, at times? We look for it in the so-called outer world. We look for it through acquisition, through accomplishment, through succeeding in different things, through relationships, through parenting, through how we organize our life. We look for meaning there. And if we find that at some point lacking, sometimes penetratingly lacking, disturbingly lacking, shakes us up. I thought this was it. All you have to do is fall in love with something and lose it, and I mean anything, to realize that the meaning and purpose that you invested in that thing is shook up when that thing dissolves or goes away or abandons you or forgets you. And I'm talking about not something that need be like a really riveting experience. I'm talking about somebody who you want to call you back doesn't. Simple as that. They should have called by now. They forgot about me. So it doesn't take very long for some human beings, once the search on the outside has kind of run its course to a certain extent, that we start searching on the inside. Because isn't that a powerful message? Go within. The truth is within. Look within. Find out who you really are. So where are you going to do that? And often the message is, go in. And so you go in. And sometimes you go way in. And what you keep finding over and over is fleeting and transitory. I want home. I want security. I want heaven. I want happiness that doesn't end. Where am I going to find it? Go in. Look inside. And if it isn't devastating, and I mean this not pejoratively, just there is devastation. If it isn't devastating to realize that you're attempts for meaning, purpose, and home that's lasting on the outside, if that isn't devastating enough, go inside and look and find that that doesn't work either. Now what? Am I making sense to you? So what do we do then? And this is common for so many people. You go out, you go in. 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 Go over here, go over there. Go with this one, go with that one. Remember that famous song from the 60s? Love the one you're with. That's not just a person, although I'm not sure what Stephen Stills really meant, because I haven't talked to him, but love the one you're with could be anything you're with. And nobody can get it to fully satisfy. So we meditate, we self-inquire, we therapize, we get as honest as we can, we tell the truth, we find people who want to be honest and truthful also, we form a community, we live together, we meditate together. We work on it. And the teachings throughout the ages support the endeavor. And yet the longing goes on. And we think the longing will be satisfied if we can become enlightened. We might not know even what we think that is, or we do have a plethora of ideas about what it is, but we think if we can get it, that'll be it. That's the crown jewel. That's the keynote. That's a pot of gold at the end of my road. Let me just take a small sort of side road here for a second and say this. Let us not confuse what I will call for the moment conventional living with awakening. there's a possibility that the way that I'm talking in some minds could condition or suggest or feed into an idea that forget about accomplishment, forget about succeeding, forget about your career, forget about improving upon, you know, your way of manifesting your talents or skills in the world. Forget about it, because it's not going to work to make you happy. Okay, let's not confuse that necessary for many of us part of life. Even a monk or a nun has a career. Let's not confuse those endeavors, those activities, the, you might call it, the evolution of those skills and talents. Let's not confuse that with awakening. Let's not confuse that with coming to realize who and what you really are, which is not in any way incompatible with careers. Even once you start to penetrate into what does right livelihood mean for me? What does it mean to live in a way that doesn't harm other beings? To earn your keep or money? What does it mean to discover the difference between needs and wants? What does it mean to find out what it means to have enough materially? Rockefeller never quite got that, because when they asked Rockefeller at that time, the richest man in the world, how much is enough, he said just a little more. Mm-hmm. Let's not confuse our so-called conventional living with the nature of awakening. They can be distinguished, but ultimately they're not separate. Awakening is the nature of the human being, in part born through the individual sense that longs for completeness or its own dissolution. This is part of awakening. There are some individuals who have no sense of wanting to not be an individual. They are narcissistically in love with themselves. I don't need to name anyone, do I? Sometimes it's us, right? You look in the mirror, you look in the reflection, and that's both literal or metaphorical, and you like what you see. You like what you see so much you fall in love, like Narcissus did when he looked into the pond, saw his own image, and just was absorbed. The reverse of that, of course, is you look at yourself and you don't like what you see. You don't like that your hair is falling out or changing color, or it never was the right color to begin with. Or you look at it and you go, let me change it again. Or however it goes. So the conventional living and awakening are fundamentally not in contradiction with one another. In fact, it's inevitable that they are one and the same. So there's many, many examples, because everyone in here has a career of sorts. And it evolves and it changes. And have you noticed that there's a certain happiness in doing what you do in your work and feeling good about it? For some of us, this is very connected to service. For others of us, it's very connected to a certain creativity, a certain inventiveness, you know, a certain talent of inventing, a certain talent of giving, a certain talent of speaking or writing, a certain talent of fixing things like pipes and computers and stuff. Let's not confuse those forms of satisfaction with what awakening really is. The individual mind sense perception, it has tremendous power. Along with time, space, path, journey, free will, choice, meaning and purpose, the individual mind sense believes and therefore experiences that actions bring consequences. Very powerful teaching. teachings of karma. Actions bring consequences. All of the religious traditions, spiritual traditions, have this in one way or another. My earliest tradition that I was brought up into, the teaching was, as you sow, so shall you reap. And it was like almost a hot iron into the mind. And there was the concept of sin and the concept of guilt and the feeling of sin and the feeling of guilt and the feeling and the longing to not have to be guilty or sinning, but not too many answers on how to get out. Just a lot of shoulds. Shoulds and shouldn'ts. And I count myself as very fortunate to have had a birth father who cut through that. And he cut through that stuff with regularity, because he used to look me in the eyes as a child and he would say, God is love. And then he shut up. He didn't say it looks like this or looks like that, or you'll get this if you do this or that. He just said, God is love, and he said it a lot. And he looked me in the eyes, and then he shut up. And he left me with that to contemplate. And there were moments of relief within this so-called madness of how to be. How do I be if I'm going to be right? So this idea of action bringing consequences is very powerful, it's very real, and we experience it every day. You do this, you get that. You do that, you get this. And on it goes. So much a part of the unfolding of the day-to-day experience that we call it reality sometimes. This is the way it really is. But when we examine those actions, we examine the very actions we're taking. Almost all the time, we're taking actions because we want to feel better. And even if we want to help somebody else feel better, somehow embedded in that, we know we'll feel better too. Or at least we want to maintain the current state of good feeling. Please, if you're hearing this with some filtration of judgment, that is just a tendency of mind. There's no judgment here. Let's just call the spade if we can. If we're not careful, we walk on planet Earth as self-conscious human beings seeking pleasure and attempting to avoid pain day after day after day after day after day. Awakening is actually the loss of self-centered consciousness. Awakening is when seeking falls away. The individual me perception, once in motion, invested in itself, will breed fear. The need for preservation, protection, and attempts to maintain a pseudo sense of security. If you talk to it, you find out that it knows it's not secure, but it wants security nonetheless. And again, as I would repeat, quite contradictory, the perceived needs of the individual me or I. It's actually looking for wholeness or oneness. It's looking for its own dissolution or decenteredness, unbeknownst to itself. If there's an effort to dissolve the ego, good luck, or an individual sense, dissolving this individual sense, this effort can only be coming from longing or craving for something other than what's actually happening. What's that going to be like? Like, how do you do that? You're going to get out an eraser and erase yourself? The individual through effort is going to dissolve the individual. And make no mistake, awareness, this unlocatable thing that's watching everything that's going on here, can be believed to be who you are. Can be the individual me perception in disguise, incognito. So what else do we do then? Oh, this teacher that many of you may know of, Eckhart Tolle, wrote the book The Power of Now. Got so popular you could buy it in Walmart. That's pretty cool, right? Top-notch, non-dual spiritual book in the shelves of Walmart. He's in agony. He's experiencing agony. He's a research scholar in some UK, British university, whatever it was, forget. But he's there and he's in agony and he just can't take it. And he has the following thought: I cannot take myself anymore. And instead of what most people do if they have that moment, and that's an agonizing moment, I cannot take myself anymore, they go to sleep, they take a drug, they distract themselves, they buy another car, I mean, whatever. He didn't, none of that happened. What happened is he went into the experience of this question, I cannot stand myself anymore. That's both a question and a statement. And he realized he didn't know whether he was the I or the me. Which is a pretty profound consideration. But then as the book goes, he fell asleep. And when he awoke, he was neither the I nor the me. He was simply spacious being. And there was no more problem. But we didn't get to find out what actually happened. Did you take a nap? I mean, if you remember that from the book, that's how it was written. Did awakening sneak up on him? Do you have to fall asleep to awaken? Must you have the question, I cannot take myself anymore? And then go into the place of, like, you don't know whether you're the I or the myself, and then fall asleep. And then you'll be done. And everything will be great. Funny thing about awakening is it's so unique. It's like our fingerprint. That's why the cops get it, because it's unique. They'll take a mugshot, but they want this one. Because you're not going to get another one just like that anywhere. Although we've been fudging with it, we human beings. We've been tweaking it if we can. Criminal mind. So the human being at times can't take it. And so they want out. And so they think about suicide. And what is suicide? Suicide is the craving for non-existence. It's the belief or the idea or the projection that if I knock myself off, I'll get out of myself. And the question that's pertinent and powerful and real and poignant is, how do you know? Having done a bit of work in the world of therapy with suicidal folks, I often find it's feeling appropriate to ask that question. How do you know? What if the act, if karma's real, what if the act of trying to knock yourself off, the violence of that perpetuates itself in a form where you have no body, but now you're in a state of consciousness, disembodied as it may be, and the agony continues? Oh, thank you, Lord Buddha, for reminding us that this life is so precious. It was sitting in this narrow space, not just like if we go a little bit too much this way in temperature or a little too low this way, we're really going to be in trouble ecologically. But not just that, we're in a band of consciousness, so to speak, where we have the so-called perfect blend of pleasantness and unpleasantness to fuel the passion of awakening, too much pleasure, and people just want to coast. Give me my gated community. Too much pain, and all you're thinking about is surviving, getting through to the next moment. I hear it again and again. If only I can get through this. Once I get this done, if I can only get over this hump, I just need to get through Christmas, or whatever it is. I don't often hear people saying, if only I can get over my birthday. Because it's still held out as this cherished moment when I was born. Don't know what that is, but I was born on my birthday. And I was named da-da-da on my birthday. And I exist. And we believe it. And we cherish it. And we celebrate it. And there's nothing wrong with it. But if we want to know who and what we really are, we need to look deeply at what we have assumed. And I want to call them the sacred cows of our spiritualized ideations. So suicide is that craving or that longing for non-existence. And conversely, the longing in the conscious state for a better tomorrow is often a seeking of something that will feel better for me. At core, again, remember, longing is longing for its own disappearance. Longing is chasing its tail. As the alchemical power of awakening, that's what we're here for. As this is taking place, the idea of individuality or separateness can spontaneously decentralize. It's very simple. Decentralization simply means it goes away for an instant. Or for more than an instant. You don't know who you are. The I goes away. The locus of being, because the I is being, the me is being itself, the locus of being moves out, so to speak, from this idea of individuality and separate me into spaciousness or openness. And I say out because it's often, for many people, felt like that. It's like an expansion. Sometimes it's a dropping. Sometimes it's just the body still sitting there, and all of a sudden it's very clear you're not the body. It just goes. There are many tastes. Steve and I were talking about tastes at the beginning of the retreat, the one taste. There are many tastes, and other languages called glimpses. I was born through therapy. I went back and remembered this birth. It was chaotic. My mother was fully drugged. She was unconscious when I was born. I was born drugged. There was drugs in her bloodstream. There was drugs in mine. That explains it all. I can say anything now, right? I was born drugged. I didn't want to remember it. I remembered it. It just came back. It came up. I remembered it. There was pain. There was trouble. And I remember these things, 1, 2, 3 years old, and came and went. Things happened. It hurt. And then one day, I'm 5 years old chronologically, and I'm in kindergarten, and we have to take a nap. It's forced upon us. We must take a nap. I lie down. I can't take a nap. I don't want to close my eyes. But we're forced to lie on our little mats and take a nap. I can't take a nap. My eyes are open. And I'm looking out these windows. And the sun is coming in, and it's warming me. And suddenly, bang, everything troubling is gone, and there's this wholeness and unicity, and it's absolutely beautiful. And then I hear the teacher's voice come in. Get up now. And the feeling of separation and discomfort came back just like that. Completely forgotten about. And somebody hands me a yoga book and I'm 17 years old and I just start doing these postures and I remember being five. The first time I remember, it was buried in the unconscious, I remember being five and having this experience of wholeness and completeness. Those kinds of things, once they're awakened, fuel the need to remember and find that which doesn't go away. All kinds of tastes, that's a taste, I'm just describing a taste. All kinds of tastes come and go. The sense is contact and object, and everything else falls away, and all there is hearing. The eyes contact an object and all there is seeing. No perception of I or me, no body, just seeing. It can happen at the sense doors in any moment. It's a taste, it's a glimpse. We meet another person, we fall in love, we join. The bodies touch, the minds touch, the feelings touch. There's feelings of unicity. Why do the French call the orgasm petit mort, small death? There's a dissolution of some degree of separation. And the individual sometimes just wants that again and again and again. And the drugs masquerade it. If you've ever talked to anyone who's used heroin, they will often say, it's the most pleasant feeling possible. There is no feeling like it. Some of you may know this personally. Almost every day, to varying degrees, the perception, the investment, the belief in individuality thins or completely goes away. It goes away completely in deep sleep, and then it comes back on the first thought as it comes out into the waking state. Why does it feel so good to fall into deep sleep? Because you don't have to be separate anymore. But that's why it's called the poor man or poor woman's nirvana. It's the best you can get until it's clear in the conscious state that you don't exist as you thought you did or do. So this locus of being can move out in any moment from this centralization of me, I over here, everything else over there. And we're here to allow that possibility. And let's be very clear, meditation, silence, is not some special domain where this awakening can occur. It's the movement of grace through the realm of consciousness of humans, and it can happen at any time in any way. It's completely beyond any tradition. It's completely beyond any method. It's completely beyond anything that's been written down. Being moves out from the sense of contracted separateness, and a little or a lot touches its own vastness. Prior to this decentralization, in the so-called experience of living prior to this, the idea or feeling of being an individual, believed in, invested in, even though it causes contraction, inhibition, fear, and unhappiness, still it's habitually clung to. And thus it persists. In awakening, the idea or feeling of individuality can still arise. But now it's seen for what it is. It's simply an idea, it's a thought. It's unique, it's creative, it's amusing, it's funny. It's who you thought you were. And if you want to really get it going, I don't suggest this as a regular practice. Just hire some people to insult you. And then the individual I or me will arise with vigor. And if you can laugh then, who's laughing? At who? it's only always been an idea or a perception. Beautiful, isn't it, to be unique? Look around the room. We're all two-legged, two arms, different genders, different ages, different skin, different face, so forth. But what do we got in common? Prior to and beyond the differences in appearance. In true meditation, as that's realized, it's not a means to an end. It's rather an end in itself. The arising of the individual I or me as thought or perception or feeling is simply one of the countless expressions of boundless life opening itself into itself. Not any more or less than anything else. So if the idea is there that let's figure out how to dissolve the individual I, well, I like to just flip that around and say, if you were all and only an individual I, how would you feel if somebody wanted to dissolve you? Probably not too good. I want to continue to be. So what I'm suggesting now is that it's the simple decentralization of this I or me that is the nature of awakening. It's the nature of the arising of wisdom and compassion. It is the unfolding truth of your true nature, even as it manifests as the individual I or me. In true meditation, nothing need be different, nothing need be added, nothing need be taken away. Everything is seen and realized to be exactly as it is, simple, direct, immediate, and spontaneous. That's the whole shebang. That means everything that was felt, thought, perceived, sensed today, now, or any moment. Openness amidst that is true meditation. So then we also see by nature everything that arises, the law is, everything that arises will change and cease. And this is the law, and yet awakening reveals that nothing need change or be different. Awakening is the spontaneous release of needs. It's the falling away of the longing. And in the opening to true meditation, there's a movement out of looking out at things into simply seeing from no center. So we often relate to the concept or teachings of mindfulness as paying attention. The eye who's mindful, paying attention to the objects that are arising and passing. And it's quite liberating to see that everything arises and passes. But meanwhile, unbeknownst to oneself, one can be solidifying the idea that I am watching everything arising and passing. Yeah, it does that to the head. Hey, yay, yay! Looking at is looking from separation. Seeing is wholeness. Another way at that. There is the senses working right now, the body sitting here. Thoughts may be happening. There's a voice speaking, hearing, so forth. Where is the I in all of this? Where is the me? Where is she or he? Even though we can't find it, we can't trace it, we can't locate it, the mind somehow believes it's real and true. All I'm saying in one sense is simply see that tendency to believe in that without any interference. See that for what it is. And then you'll see that the I or me perception is simply an object that comes and goes, like all other objects. It's a kind of an inversion. One other way to do it is look inside from some place that you think you can look at things from and try to find yourself. I mean, kids have this game sometimes. You know, show me where you are. I mean, and they play it out in different ways. This movement into seeing things as they are is wholeness. Right? It's unicity. It's completeness. And then there's a sense of just living fully into this huge expanse that we often call life, freed up from the ideas that we've been carrying around about time, the way the thought can evaluate or measure time, falling into ideas that there isn't enough time, that's pressure, or there's too much time, that's boredom. Moving past the bemoaning time's passage, sometimes that happens, we bemoan events passing. Look at the picture and wish we were back there. Move past that, or falling prey to the unexpected and the challenging occurrences. And boy, aren't they? The unexpected and challenging occurrences that just can come in. Falling prey to that, and then getting lost in confusion about a wonderful gift of living miraculously on the edge all the time. Any one of us could just die. Last breath. Right there over the left shoulder, as Don Juan used to say, Le Carlos Castaneda in the mountains of Mexico, death is always over your left shoulder. This wasn't to like make him, you know, frightened. It was to say, wake up. This gift of being alive in wisdom and compassion, this is really the whole of the awakened life said in one sentence. Being alive in and as wisdom and compassion. What does this mean? The wisdom reveals that all is unpossessable and transitory. There is no solidity anywhere. Call it waves, call it particles, call it whatever you want. There's no solidity anywhere. There is no solid I or me. This is wisdom. Wisdom reveals this non-possessible, transitory ephemeralness. And compassion reveals that all of it is equally valuable and worthy of care. All of it. Every particular. Every sensation, every feeling, every thought, every perception, everything is worthy of care. Is worthy of our attention. And so then that gift is to see without interfering, without interrupting, without prejudice or bias. And when prejudice, bias, or interfering arises, to see that for what it is. This reduces the helter-skelter mind and brings more tranquility and insight, such that you can be in the most challenging situations and simply pause and stop right there in the middle of it and just go into openness. It's a byproduct. Taking care of all aspects of life, every day, every moment, isn't some spiritual or material ideal. It's a wholehearted respect, and actually it's the nature of our innermost heart. This is pointing at possible meaning, but I don't even want to suggest that. I'm just talking about possibilities. So I'd like to conclude this with a poem from a very gifted poet. This is the poetry of David White. This poem is called Tuxtan. Tuxtan Monastery, the tiger's nest. 2,000 feet to the valley floor. After many days alone in the mountains, the body hesitates at the sight of a single roof. Having listened to the wind, sufficient to itself, like a single clear breath from the body of the mountain, we hear the sutra's diamond-hard presence. at the center of experience so clearly now, spoken from the felt rhythm of a 10-day walk. And having crossed the pass in cold rain, we wait, about to ripen into our own going. Like a drop of clear water hanging from the cliff edge, its own transparent world growing from within, until it fills with just enough to flow on, out of the mountains as we do. So silent now, only the sound as we go, of that pure water falling towards home. So silent now, only the sound as we go, of that pure water falling towards home. If we could just take a couple of minutes to sit together now, please.